My name is Fred McCandless, and I am teaching the penultimate session on the Enneagram system. We have been going through this all week in various forms, teaching various parts of this system, and they all kind of work together to make a real good understanding of what I'm doing. If you're new to the system, that's okay, because I'll be repeating a lot of these sessions this next week, and if a lot of this sounds alien and I don't know what's going on, what is this guy talking about tonight, it will make sense. The Enneagram system is basically about motivation. It's about the interaction of three different motivational centers that everybody has. And in every person, one of these centers tends to predominate. And when we get under stress, one center will tend to overcompensate. Now, the three different centers that you see here are the head and the heart and the gut center. And a brief explanation of this, because it's important for what I'm going to talk about tonight.
How do you do?
Now, if I didn't know him, this might be an issue. But I do, and it's still an issue. Now, Tom's with me all week. He's a good friend of mine.
Tom Westbrook.
Tom, why don't you stand up and introduce yourself? No. Okay. These different centers indicate different ways we have of dealing with the world. If you tend to fall into a gut center, that tends to mean that this is the center that really controls your survival, your way of being, your way of confronting the world, putting yourself into it, expressiveness. If you're a head-centered person, this is your analytical ability. This is the way you kind of tend to look at things first, rationally. Like you may start to make comparisons between what happened before, what's going to happen next time, putting yourself into a planning mode. Putting things together. Where a gut-centered person their expression might be, just do it. The head center says, what if? Well, what if I do it differently? Well, what happened last time? And we all have these centers, and they're all in us all the time. I want to reemphasize that. The heart center is our emotional center. It's where our feelings are. When somebody asks you, how are you feeling? That's a difficult question, because a feeling isn't a how, a feeling is a what. I feel sad. How does a process work? It can confuse some people. It's like saying, what do you think you're feeling? There can be a hesitation, but a feeling is a way of keeping us on track, keeps us on course, feedback. Our emotional need for approval. I want to be liked. If as a presenter, I come in and alienate people, and I don't have contact on an emotional level, some kind of approval, even if some of you disagree, if I somehow push you away, then I'm not going to be able to reach you with the rest of the information. So each one of these centers acts to do two things. Promote your life and defend your life. Your self-identity. What we've been talking about this week are that there are basically nine different styles within this system. And I'll put that up here. And there's going to be a lot of lines and circles, but I think you'll understand it once you see it. Each different center breaks down into three different types. But it's the mixture of the centers which creates it. Now this looks kind of silly, like a geometry class out of control. These are the different names for the different types. And I'm not going to spend a lot of time tonight going into the motivation inside each type, because I want to talk about the spectrum that each particular personality lives in. Now, if you've got questions, please raise your hand. I want to make this very interactive, and especially for new people, or if you might want some clarification, raise your hand and I'll do my best. One thing I have to tell you now is that there's so much in the system that I want to share with you, I have to leave out a lot. And I may accidentally leave out the piece of information that for you would give you that aha, I understand. Each one of these types, and I call them types, but they're really perspectives. I think of them more as a hometown. Everybody has one. We all come from someplace. That doesn't mean you can't travel around the world. It just means that you usually have a place you go home to. And in our most comfortable self, we tend to stay pretty much at home. So the mixture of the different centers creates the different types, the different areas. The champion, the negotiator, and the inspector are part of the gut center. That's their dominant center. That's the one they tend to use. The self-identity for this champion is I am powerful. It's a presence. It's something I'm going to step in and I'm going to be in your face. I'm going to push the world physically. I'm going to push it to see where I can be. I'm going to push you to see how far I can push. And what I really want you to do is push back. If you don't push back, I keep going until I find resistance. And believe it or not, that resistance is pleasing to this particular type. Because once they find the resistance, they know how much they can trust you. The negotiator 9 defines themselves as being okay. No conflict. That's the issue. Dissipate the conflict and turn it away. Turn it into, just smooth it out. The inspector 1 says, I am hardworking. These gut-centered types have this way of trying to impose order, challenging the outside world. This is expressiveness. So you may run into somebody who says, this should really be this way instead of this way. And what they're trying to do is impose order on what they consider to be chaos. Whether or not it really affects you, they're not that concerned. What they want to do is make that order happen. So there's this structure that tends to happen. And what they're trying to do is make sure the lines are straight. Make sure the grass is cut. Make sure everything happens to keep it all together. Because rules have to be made, otherwise chaos will rule. Okay, this is, remember, a gut. Down in the heart center, you have the assistant and the administrator and the author. The assistant, being primarily heart center, says, I am helpful. Meeting your needs is what I want to do. Sometimes they forget to meet their own needs. The administrator 3 says, I am successful. I want your help to meet my needs. I have a goal that I want to achieve, and I need your help to do it. So what can I say to you? What need do you have that I can meet so you'll meet my need? So strongly do they associate with their goals that they say, if I am what I do, if the project that I'm working on fails, then I am a failure. But if it succeeds, then I'm a success. So they set things out in a very logical way. I need to reach this goal, so I need to go here first, then here, then here. And they give themselves benchmarks to measure progress. Very good project leaders, project managers, and coaches, because they tend to know what their goal is, and they will reach that any way they can. Sort of like 10 yards, you get a first down. So the goal is go to 10 yards, then go the next 10 yards, until finally you get the touchdown, which is the end result you're really seeking. The author 4 defines themselves as being unique. Special. That's a better word, really, than unique, because they want to feel special inside, and they want you to know that they're special. But somehow, because they're really kind of farthest from their gut, they tend to feel it more inside and not express it as well. This can be a problem in communication when you ask them how they're doing, and they go, so the need to communicate is there. Outwardly, not just inwardly. Moving over to the head center, you have the Sage 5. This is the person who tends to be very intellectual, analyzing, thinking, accumulating information. They define themselves as being knowing and having knowledge. That's what's important. And the more knowledge they have, the better they feel. The better they think. The facilitator 6 is defining themselves as being loyal. What's important to them is the group. How is the group doing? Is the group happy? Is the group upset? What is the threat to the group? So sometimes these particular people look very paranoid, like they've got too much on their minds and they're not quite sure what to do next. It's because where the sage will handle information by compartmentalizing and putting it away, the facilitator handles information by keeping it up in front of them. All of the different choices, all of the different parameters, they keep this in front of them. So if anything changes, they can then change the order. They can keep it alive. That's why the group orientation is so good. They don't have to worry. If they're doing what the group is doing, then they're doing fine. And they're always alert to changes in the group. The Optimist 7 defines themselves as being joyful, delightful, fun. Very enthusiastic people, very good storytellers. A lot of ideas, a lot of thinking that goes on, but they kind of think like a pinball machine works. They take an idea, they pull it back, and they launch it, and all of this exciting bells and whistles and all this crashing around starts to happen. But sometimes at the end, the ball drops down the hole. And you're not really sure what's happened. There's been a lot of excitement. But it's more fun because they can just launch another idea. So there's a lot of excitement intellectually, but not a lot of follow through outwardly. So 7 or 8 projects might get started and not finished because one project leads to a new project, which is much more interesting than finishing the details of the old ones.
Is that like when you forget the mail, the materials that you promised are in the mail that day?
Moving on. All right, does anybody have a question at this point? I know that some of you haven't had all the information and I'm going sort of fast. I have very good examples of the different types, and I've passed out a bunch of handouts, and if you're sitting near somebody that has a lot of paper in their hand, like this woman over here.
8 pages.
Please share with the people around you if they haven't seen it, so they can... The object of what I'm doing here is to try and help you determine which area is your preference. Now the idea is that, if you're over here, then you'll never understand this area. All of these different perspectives are in you all of the time. The idea is that out of all 9 of them, you're going to prefer one, and that most of your automatic behavior, and this is behavior you don't really know you're doing because you're not aware of it, it's driven by the needs that are inside of you. And I use this example during the workshop, and there's basically 3 states of awareness. There is dreaming sleep, which we do lying down every night. There's waking sleep, which we do walking around every day. And then there's consciousness. And this idea of consciousness is that it doesn't really last very long for most of us. We're not usually aware of our behavior, so we tend to make the same mistakes or the same reactive behavior over and over and over. Well, when we're small, some kinds of behavior are good. They keep us safe. But as we get older, this behavior can actually sabotage what we're trying to do with our lives. It may be a good idea when you're little to take care of people because you're afraid that if you don't, they're going to leave. But as you get older, fulfilling someone else's needs may actually prevent you from fulfilling your own. So we create our identity. Some of it's inborn. We have a tendency to be more one center than another because it's our want. But personality, they're not sure if it's a genetic thing. Is it inherited? Do we get it from our parents? They say you get insanity from your children. Or from your parents. But that's just a saying. Yes?
I don't know if you covered this before, but what is the relationship of the lines?
I'm glad you asked that, because that's why we're here tonight.
Maybe you'll come to this, but is there, the nearness of certain, if you find yourself a 2, might you have 1 tendencies, or would you have, or 3 tendencies if you're a 2, just because you're sort of close together on the circle, or?
Okay. There's a theory that's going around with some of the Enneagram information about wings. Now the idea with a wing is that, if you're here, do you take on some of the characteristics of the type next to you? So if you're an assistant and you define yourself by being helpful to other people, do you sometimes maybe take on a little bit of the perfectionism of the inspector saying, you really have to change. You really should be better than you are. And it looks like it works for some of the types. But for the triad types, I call that the triad because they're on the triangle, the 3, the 6, and the 9, it doesn't really function well. Because what this person is saying here is that, if I'm already a heart-centered person, then maybe I have a little bit of gut energy, so that makes me more gut person sometimes. I tend to dominate. That center becomes dominant. And the idea of the centers is critical, that you always have your dominant center. The idea is that this secondary center has a lot of influence. So yes, the assistant can look like they're taking on that perfectionistic ability, that ability of discernment. But they're primarily feeling. And what they're trying to do is relate with you and help you. So by telling you to improve, they really think they're helping. And what they're really doing is making you mad. But they don't want that to happen. It's the relationship that's important. And I disagree, because what happens here is you have the 3 who's in the center of the heart. And whether the 3 then uses the 2 or the 4, they're just more heart. So it doesn't really allow them to have the energy of the other centers. And that's why I don't like the idea of shared neighborhoods. Okay. And what I'm going to talk about tonight is the lines. Now, The symbol itself is really old. It was devised many thousands of years ago, and we're not sure who drew it. It may have just been a scribble in the sand. But it seems to be organized around the idea of observing behavior. Now, the key to the Enneagram is that it's dealing with motivation, not so much with behavior. But what's observable is our behavior. And I've talked with many people here this week who say, oh, I know what type so-and-so is. Because it's usually a lot easier for us to observe somebody else and by their traits try to pigeonhole them than it is to work on ourselves. We're not really aware of what we do, but we are aware, we can be aware of what drives us. What's driving our car? What drives us down the road of our lives? Have you picked up a hitchhiker and let them do the driving?
Would it be more valid to have like your family go through and help you, since they're more observable of what your behavior is and you're thinking inside yourself?
Pretty much. We're always in the car. We can't always tell the map that we're on. And I think of the Enneagram as a map. So if you use your friends, your close friends, not people that don't like you.
Just a few.
And they can be helpful too. The idea is that we can be mirrors for each other. That if you observe certain behavior in somebody, and once you've understood this system, you can say, this person really seems to have this kind of a tick. Especially in an argument where people tend, when they get in stress and they get into self-protective mode, they start to exhibit really almost predictable behavior. The idea is to be able to learn to see it yourself. There's a short story I'll share with you about a man who was one day walking down a street. And in front of him was an open hole he didn't see. He walked in and he fell down into the middle of this hole and was surrounded by goop. It was in the sewer. It was awful. Very uncomfortable. So he found the ladder and he climbed out and he went home. Now the next day, he was on his way to work again. He walked down the same street. Knew there was something about this street that happened, but wasn't quite sure what it was. Fell in the open hole again. There he was, down in the garbage. Had to get back up and go home. Now the next day, walking to work, same path, same street, saw the open hole, thought I should probably avoid this, but fell into it anyway. Now most of you might be thinking, why doesn't this guy get a clue? It's because this is automatic behavior. He's walking the same way he always walks. But the next day, he walked down the street, he saw the hole, he said, I should probably walk around it, but he fell into it anyway. And the next day, he took a different street. The point is that we have these automatic compulsive behaviors that we are so unaware of, we walk into them so quickly that we forget. We don't know. Self-remembering is one of the hardest things we have to do as human beings. What I'm trying to help people do is maybe even if you can just be aware of one thing that you do, maybe one thing you say in a conversation with somebody. This is what's become to known in the Enneagram, well, I hate to say industry, but there are a lot of people trying to understand the system now, as the arrow theory. Now, the idea of the lines has been in the symbol since anybody saw it. Yeah. It's only been taught like this in group situations in the United States for about, 20, 25 years. So there's theory about, well, what do the lines mean? And a woman named Maria Beesing, who's done a lot of work with the Enneagram, started looking at the similarities in the types. A lot of the week we've been talking about the differences, how the assistant 2 differs from the author 4, from the optimist 7, from the champion 8. And what this really does is say, if you find yourself in the area of the 2, for example, you find yourself as an assistant, what that really means is that you exist on a continuum between this author 4 and this champion 8. You're somewhere on this road. And think of it as a map, that if this is where you live, the arrow indicates the path of least resistance. That under stress and in compulsive behavior, if your needs aren't met, you're going to flow this way. And that the effort, the ability to become more self-aware, like of things behind you, means going against the arrow, means kind of hiking uphill. It's more effort. It's a lot easier to walk down a hill. It's a lot easier to jump off or ride your bike down a hill. But doing that work to get to the top, that's what self-awareness is about. Trying to make a difference in your life by becoming more aware of what you're doing. This isn't a big secret. This sounds like, well, this is really obvious. But what I'm going to help you learn is that there are certain needs that each type has that when they're met, going against this arrow is a lot easier. And I'll use the assistant too as my starting point. The two identifies themselves as being helpful. It is easier for me to meet your needs than it is for me to acknowledge my own needs. It's easier for me to say, can I get you something? Anything? You're sure? I'd really like to get you something. Because until I've been given something to do for this person, or any of you, then I feel like, well, I'm not being useful. I'm not useful, I'm not worthwhile. And this is a need that's very deep inside. So when you say, oh, I'll have a cup of coffee, that's great, I'll go get it. Now that I know, I might even put sugar in it for you. I'll say this, you know, you look like you've been wearing those clothes a long time. I've got another pair of pants. Would you like to wear them? In fact, I don't know if they're your size, so I'll run down to the store. I'm sure there's something there. It can get out of hand. Right? Now the need that the two has besides meeting your needs is what they're doing is if I meet your needs, then I'll get you to appreciate me. I will receive love in the form of appreciation if I get my need met. Because what happens is the two is that they're not sure how to meet their own needs. It's very difficult for me to say, would you get me a cup of coffee? Because my definition is I'm supposed to help you get a cup of coffee. Hard. And even harder on an emotional level where I want to tell you how I'm feeling. Now I'm not a two, I'm just going into this to show you. It's harder for me to tell you what I need on an emotional level than it is for me to anticipate your emotional needs. So if I have a need to express something painful, it's going to be more difficult for me. It's easier for me to say, listen, please, can I do something? Can I do something for you? When the two doesn't get the appreciation, they'll drop down this long, lonely road, and they take on the negative style of this particular point, which is the vengeance. The lowercase letters indicate the decline, what I call the decay of the type. And the bold capital letters indicate the growth. So the two doesn't grow. They'll settle for attention if they can't get appreciation. The thing they need to do is start to express their own needs. Rather than trying to depend on you to tell them who they are, to define themselves, they start to take on the sensitivity of the author. Now, the author we described as being special. They really, that's their name. They define themselves as being special. The assistant doesn't. But when they start to realize, hey, I'm really good at this. I'm really creative at this. I can really quilt. Or I can really create the most wonderful sculpture. I can express myself. Then they start to take on this artist quality. They start saying, I really can't drive you to baseball practice today. I'm going to my quilting class. I'm doing this for me. I'm not doing it for you. But what happens is, because they start feeling better about themselves, they actually start becoming more healthy. And they start actually taking better care of the people that they are loving and responsible to. The administrator here defines themselves as being successful. The image of Tom Cruise in the movie Top Gun, where he's always kind of in the front, very arrogant, very successful, wants to be successful, wants to look at everybody and say, look at me, aren't I terrific? And when they succeed, they're doing very well. They appear to be. But when the failure happens, like in the movie where his friend is killed, and he blames it on himself, he says, this was my fault. I'm a failure. This is disastrous. Then what happens is the three goes back with the arrow and takes on this sloth quality of a real powerless nine. They start doing things that don't have any effect. Maybe vacuuming the house over and over and over, or just kind of going for walks aimlessly. There's a lack of direction, which, remember, for this administrator, their idea is goal-centered. As long as they're striving and they're being competitive, they feel much better about themselves. So when they drop backwards into this lethargy, it's like this whole power has been sucked out of a room or out of them, and they're despondent. But they don't show it very well. They just kind of walk slowly, and it could lead to all kinds of problems. Because the people they deal with say, geez, what's wrong with you? And that just compounds the problem. Because now they think, God, now there's something wrong with me. and it looks like depression, but it's like what they need is something new to do. Something to feel good about themselves. Maybe go back in their secret room and look at all their old bowling trophies. They need examples of where they've succeeded in order to start pulling out of this. But what really helps them is when they go against that arrow and they fight and become more responsible, like the six, where they start to invest themselves and their talent in improving the group, where their goal is less for them and more for the community at large. Referring back to the Top Gun movie, at the end, after Maverick, Tom Cruise has decided that, well, it's too dangerous. I can't go into this battle. He actually turns around and gets back into the battle and saves the life of his friends and becomes the hero of the day. Not because he did it for himself, but because he did it for others. So when the three's goals become aligned with the group's goals, when the three actually does something for the group, that's when they start to get their real self-esteem up. Because the group then says, you're wonderful. We're glad that you're part of us. We're glad you're here. Because what the three is used to hearing is, aren't you terrific by yourself? So on this continuum, you might find someone who's very goal-oriented, but more concerned with the group. And so they might be somewhere on the continuum along this line. They may not be all the way over here. They're never going to be a different type. But their outward behavior tends to reflect those characteristics of a different type. Okay, the three does not become a six. Right? Because when the six is healthy, they have somewhere else that they go. Okay? So they never really, this is not changing type. It's just, I've got enough self-esteem, I can visit Missoula now, even though I live in Arizona. They have the ability to be able to say, yeah, I can do this. The author four, because they are so sensitive emotionally, probably one of the more sensitive types of the Enneagram, especially emotionally sensitive. They, like I explained, they ride an emotional roller coaster because in order to feel that specialness, they need the intensity of feeling. So they can feel extremely joyful 1 second, and then within a few minutes, be all the way down in despair. So they ride this emotional roller coaster up and down, and it tires a lot of people out. They think, I'm so special. Look at me. I'm at this party, and all eyes are on me. I'm so special. And then they see somebody with the same outfit on. And they feel like they have to disappear or they have to do something more dramatic because now this other person is here and they're doing things. So they become ordinary. That's their fear. I don't want to be ordinary. I want to be special. I want to be somebody exceptional. So what happens here is that in a state of what I call high ego, low self-esteem, the four falls down the line into the flattery. That's a lot like a real negative two. By flattery, I mean that they'll get into relationship with someone and try to meet their needs a little bit because that person helps define them. The person tells them, these are the emotions you should feel. So they start living off somebody else's cues, maybe off a rehearsed part, rather than being themselves. And when they're feeling very healthy, they climb this ladder, they climb up this arrow into the discernment of the inspector. They have the ability to somehow see where something more aesthetic would really work. They tend to be very good interior designers. They tend to see how patterns fall together and they create something brand new. Now this may even be a cause that they become involved in that they start to really believe in. And remember, the hardest thing down here is that the heart center and the head center are both interior centers. They're not very expressive, so this ability to express actually frees the author from this interminable self evaluation and need to have extreme emotion. They can discern that, oh, it's okay to be ordinary, but even in being ordinary, I can be extraordinary. I can do something extraordinarily new that benefits a lot of other people, and it'll benefit them. They may create a wonderful work of art, but it's in the creation of that work that their self-esteem goes high, because they are able to somehow communicate what they're feeling so that other people know about it. And then they get that specialness. They get that Vincent van Gogh was a wonderful painter. He was a very troubled author, as far as everything that I've seen and read about him. I visited the Van Gogh Museum in Amsterdam in January, and I was just moved by the amount of passion, the paintings, and feeling the pressure. Emotional pressure is the best way I can describe what I felt when I watched them. And I looked at them and I thought, this guy was really troubled. But he had a real difficult time. His feelings overwhelmed him. And in the end, he just lost control. He fell back into this because people weren't really applauding his work when he was alive. It wasn't until afterwards. So it was a terrible time. But it's this discernment, this ability to see themselves in perspective with the rest of everyone else that really frees them. When you cross over into the head center, the first head center or the first head type is the five, the sage who defines themselves as being knowing. I'm a knowledgeable person. I have the right answer. I can sit here and explain to you all day exactly what this should be, and of course you're going to love my answer because I'm going to give you the definitive answer. Unfortunately, for the sage, a lot of their trouble comes again, like the author, with their inability to really express themselves in a gut way. Talking is not a gut thing to do for the most part. Explaining, you won't find a lot of gut-centered people who explain things to you. The one will give you instructions. This, and this. And that's all they'll say. If the eight tells you that much, you're lucky. And the nine, sometimes they don't talk very much, but their presence is always with you. So this is a lot of explicating down here. And when the self-identity of being knowing is threatened, they tend to talk a lot. They're trying to explain their feelings. They're trying to explain to you how you feel and why you feel that way. And by the God, do you know how feelings got started? Well, let me tell you a little thing about feelings. And then pretty soon you've got a treatise on feelings, and what you said was, all you want to hear is fine. You ask them how they're feeling, and sometimes they feel this need to really kind of conceptualize it and put it down and give it to them. When they're feeling very unhealthy, when they're feeling low self-esteem, like they don't know enough, sometimes they will drop down the line all the way and take on the negative side of the seven, which is the escapism. They're not really sure what's real, because they usually deal with empirical data, things that can be proven, mathematical formulas. The capital of Afghanistan, how many peas in a pod, you know, things that they can go out and count and understand, and then they put that information away. But when they drop into the escapism, it's a mental escapism. They start imagining facts. Because they're so adept at explaining, and they know so much, how are you supposed to know when what they're telling you is false? So they start to wonder, well, I got to give some kind of an answer. I better just do it off the top of my head. And you'll see the struggle between what they really know and what they imagine that they know. And they may, and in fact, they are a withdrawing type. So under stress, they're going to tend to pull back. And even sitting right in front of you, they can just pull back into their head and put their hands like this and hide. They hide behind the steeple fingers. They'll sit behind the desk. They might even sit inside the closed door and talk to you from the bathroom while they're busy looking in the almanac for what you don't know. In their strength, they take what they know and they say, I know enough. I know more. I'm going to forget more than these people are going to learn. And they move against the arrow. They move against the resistance and they take on the strength of this powerful eight. Now, where the four will take on the discernment and the ability to see what needs to be done and create something, this wonderful sage will take on the strength of the eight and become a very good leader. Not just because they've read most of the leadership books around, but because their ability to have insight into problems and situations and to take that knowledge and apply it is usually very decisive and not questioned. They have an internal strength that comes out, and they say, I can do this. And people say, well, this guy really knows a lot. Let's follow him. Let's see where he's going, because obviously he's got a good idea. a lot of the inventions that we talk about have come from these sages that take the time to actually create the invention. Where would we be without the telephone, the overhead projector, the light bulb, the VCR, except for programming the clock? 12, 12, 12. Now, for most people, they think, oh, I'll just somehow cover it up with masking tape. That's a different story. Okay. That was a trick. That was done on purpose. It doesn't have to flash, but oh well, we'll make it do that to get their attention. But the ability to use that strength of the eight and have that self-confidence that they can do it with what they know, but they don't have to accumulate even more data before they can act. Now, some people say that Yoda in Star Wars is a five. I tend to agree. But his inner strength is using the Force. He's learned how to use this power to become somebody. Robin Williams in Awakenings, as the doctor that somehow manages to free these people. He makes a difference in their lives. And I think that's what I'm getting at tonight is, how do you make a difference in your life and the people around you? Making a difference means being willing to change your course. Take that risk that at first you're going to be more aware, and you may not like what you're first aware of, but that it will come on slowly, and that even the smallest change is a great victory. Speaking of victory, move over to the six. The facilitator six defines themselves as being loyal. They're very responsible people because that's what you're supposed to be. They follow the norms of the group. When the six is having a real bad time and they feel like they're deviating from the group, which is their fear that they're going to deviate from the norm, they take on the egotism of the three. Now remember, the positive three is working more toward what's good for everybody. It's good for me, but it's going to help other people. The negative six comes over here and says, all right, if I'm deviant, I'm going to be really deviant. If I can't be part of the group, I really won't be. And they take on this, it's almost an annoying intrusion. Because what they're feeling, what they really want is to become part of the group again. But they feel ostracized or excluded. They're the soldier who somehow doesn't have the respect of the men and decides he's going to do what he wants to do. Now, the military is a very good example of sixes. Not that everybody in the military falls into the category, but the group of the military with the uniforms. Everybody looks pretty much the same. And when you salute in the military, you're saluting the uniform, the insignia, the rank. You're not saluting the person. So the people become pretty much disposable. Well, when a six drops down into this area, that's what they're feeling, that they're disposable. Very low self-esteem. And that separates them from the group. Example, Luke Skywalker in Star Wars. He wants to join the Rebel Alliance to be this wonderful, to be part of this wonderful group that's doing this wonderful thing. But he doesn't believe in himself. He doesn't have that center of, I am who I am, and I like that. He looks for his definition outside. So he gets into this thing and says, I'm just not going to take any responsibility. I'm going to run away from home. Very selfish. And that's what I mean by egotism. The six becomes selfish instead of group-oriented. When they become more centered and more positive, they climb up the ladder and get the harmony of the nine. They take the negotiator's ability to realize, hey, I'm okay. I have personal power. And for the first time in their lives, they're not looking over their shoulder, wondering what to do next or how to fit in. They say, I can dress differently and still be part of the group. I can be an individual and not just another drop in the water in the ocean. And again, to use the example of Luke Skywalker, he realizes that the Force is within him. He almost gets killed doing it. But it takes that kind of waking up, and then he forgets, and he has to go and learn it from Yoda again, and he thinks he still can't do it because he drops the ship into the swamp after all this effort. I can't do it, I can't do it, I can't do it. But then when he finally realizes he can, he becomes a great warrior. He becomes able to face his darkest fears. A lot of the teachers who teach the Enneagram say that, oh, sixes are just fear-driven. And I say, no. Fear doesn't have much to do with what the six is really concerned about. They're concerned with safety, being in the group, but they also have the ability to be alert and aware of everything that's going on around them. and around the group. Anything that presents a threat, they want to take care of. But usually, they'll tell something like, hey, this is happening over here. Would you take care of it? How about you? Well, what do you think? Do you think we should take care of it? And so instead of saying, yes, this needs to be taken care of, go take care of it, which is an ability to take charge, they tend to defer the authority. Find the person in charge and let them take care of it. When they move here, they take care of it. Becomes something that they're capable and believe that they can do. And belief has a lot to do with all of this. Coming around to this optimist seven, the seven defines themselves as being enthusiastic, right? I'm delightful, I have a good time. There's no problem anywhere. And I can just kind of walk through life like Maria von Trapp in The Sound of Music and sing my songs and everybody be happy, right? And if you're sad, it's a stormy night, well, come into my bed, I'll sing you a song, and then I'll get yelled at, and then I'll make clothes out of drapes. Seven is constantly trying to avoid the pain that is part of being human. Okay? Do you remember The Sound of Music? I see a confused look over here. Never mind. That's all right. The character of Robin Williams in Good Morning Vietnam, where he plays this disc jockey, and he's got this thing, and he's got to do all this, and he's really funny, and he's high energy all the time, and he's always looking for fun. When he finally experiences the pain of what it means to be in Vietnam and sees people dying and has to deal with this emotion, then there's a big change. And remember that the seven is primarily head-centered, very fast-thinking, very quick-witted, likes to play with words and make puns and jokes and say things that are fun to do. But they're also next to the gut center, so what they think, they kind of say right away. And they're not necessarily concerned with how you feel about it emotionally. They're not even really concerned about how they feel about it emotionally, because their emotional center is the least developed. So when the seven has a problem, say they've made a joke and they've accidentally hurt somebody's feelings, somebody they love, they slip down the slide into this indignation of the one. And it's not indignation, it can be outwardly directed, but mostly it's against themselves. That was such a stupid thing to do. Why did I do that? Or if you criticize an idea, they might think, well, who do you think you are to criticize my idea? It's a good idea. And what they do is they push people away. They're trying to make themselves feel better by not feeling bad. And instead of just saying, I'm sorry I hurt your feelings, and having that sense of despair for a few minutes, and then asking you to say, can you forgive me? I was a nut. That was a bad thing for me to say. The seven says, I'll just get mad about it. I'll push you away. And so the enthusiasm, instead of being directed toward happiness, is directed toward protection. The interesting thing about their growth is that they find their way into the wisdom of the five. And what that means for the seven is taking that just almost extroverted thinking and focusing it and making a choice. I'm good at a lot of things. I'm a jack of all trades and a master of none. But you know, I'd really like to be good at this. So I'm going to make a choice and I'm going to finally declare a major. I know it's been 12 years, Mom, but this is what I really want to do. Or it can be, I've had all of these relationships in my life. I've been out with hundreds of people, men or women. There's no gender to these types. But I really want to marry you. And by marrying you, I forsake all others. And I make this decision to be in a family. And it's very hard for a seven because their inclination is, this is going to be too hard. This is going to require me to be sensitive. God, I hate being sensitive. I just want to play. I want to be Peter Pan. I want to fly to Neverland and have fun all my life. I never want to grow up. In fact, Peter Pan maybe could be the god of sevens. And wouldn't it be fun to live at Disneyland?
Yeah.
All the time? Except for buying the food.
Or Holden Village.
Or Holden Village, what a place. It's a perfect, it's an escapism. That's what keeps them from moving forward. But when they take on that decisiveness, then they take all this wonderful energy and they start to learn everything about what they want to do. And because of their electricity and their enthusiasm and their ability to relate things that may not look related, they can invent new paradigms, new models, whether it be socially or theoretically for new kinds of physics or new kinds of inventions. When they do that, they become entrepreneurs. They come up with these new ideas. I'll bet you didn't know if you shaped a piece of meat into a circle, put two pieces of circular bread on it, and a little bit of secret sauce, you could make $10 billion. And your name's not even Wendy. I like that the girl in Peter Pan's name was Wendy. Now there's a restaurant named Wendy's. Makes you wonder, huh? When you come up to the eight finds themselves as being powerful. Here I am, deal with me. They don't mind interrupting a conversation to ask a question. Do they?
Okay.
It's because they're not worried about how you feel about it. It's just they have what they want. They want it now. Please give it to me. Now, if possible, let them go first. Then they won't try to cut in front of you. This sense of power that's confusing, because being powerful doesn't mean keeping it. Acting like a reservoir for power doesn't make you more powerful. It just makes you appear more powerful, but it doesn't make you more powerful. So what happens with the eight, when they're used to pushing up against the world like this, and if they come up into conflict with you and you start pushing back, and they're going like this, and they realize, uh-oh, this person's really more powerful than I am, the eight will suddenly withdraw. And they go, whoosh, and there you go, flat on your face. So they win. What happens is that the eight goes into this business here of the miserliness of the five. Now, by miserliness, when the five has this miserliness, they withhold information. It's like gold, and they don't want to give it away. Especially when they don't think they know what they're doing. Well, I'm not going to tell you very much, because if I give too much away, I won't have any more. You'll figure me out, and you'll ruin me. When the eight goes into this miserliness, they hold all their power in. They'll let the car crash. They'll just let things happen, because usually they're involved and they're at a key point. They're maybe like the CEO of a company who has the power and is guiding the company, and then when things get hot, I'm going to Tahiti for 6 weeks, I'll see you. And while he's gone, everything just kind of collapses, so they can't be blamed when they come back, because it happened while they were gone. But what's needed is for them to be there, for the eight to take the power and empower other people. They take on the service of the two, and I want to extend service to mean not just taking care of others. They don't just give other people things. They're actually generous. It's an altruistic giving, because they don't expect to give it back. There's no strings attached. It's like, I have a project and I'm going to give it to you, and I expect that you're going to do it, and I have faith in you to do it. Do it. And that might be all they say. Do it is really one of their great big terms.
Just do it.
Ask Agnes. Agnes is my eight friend from Colorado who came in today. And if you want to learn more about them, be careful. But so it's that willingness to give up the power, and then the most astonishing thing happens. They actually get more. By giving it away, they get more. And then by giving that away, they get more. So they become more comfortable, and people don't find them so abrasive. Because sometimes what eights will do, will walk into a situation and take the power and disempower people, which actually makes people not like them. Remember, they're furthest from their emotional center. They're far away from here. So this climb all the way over to here is a hard journey. Because the want is to be powerful. But how can I be powerful if I give it away to you? Because what happens is you start to like me. So my sensitive side starts to be revealed. And that's frightening. But it's the only way to grow. Now this up here, at the peak of the Enneagram, well, at least when it's up on the screen, is the Negotiator 9, who defines themselves as being peaceful. I am okay. No conflict, please. I'd rather not have it in my life. I'd rather not have it in your life. The image of Gerald Ford, after Watergate, saying, okay, I'm going to pardon Nixon. We've got to get this behind us. And taking the country on forward, so we wouldn't get bogged up in all of this scandal. It was a very critical time, coming at the end of the Vietnam War, and everything was up in arms, and Nixon's here, and he's done all these terrible things. So Ford very calmly, and there was no hoo-ha about it, he just said, smooth it over. Let's get rid of the conflict. That is an example of how the nine in a positive space move sort of into administrative role. They come out of the background, which is where they like to be, because they're almost camouflaged. You almost can't see them sometimes. When you ask them a question, it sometimes takes a while for them to formulate their answer because they're not sure how to answer. They don't want to say something that's going to upset you because that would create conflict. But at the same time, they want to express themselves, but not at the sake of having a problem. So to make a big decision and to become in the spotlight, that's scary. But that's the most necessary thing because the nine needs to learn how to assert themselves. I have a friend who had been married for 20 years. And the marriage had pretty much gone sour after 10. But they stayed in it. Not because they were afraid, but because the conflict would be too much to bear. But after that 10 years, they had the courage to say, I'm not happy anymore, and I have to do this for me. I have to stand up here and put this to an end. And it was a difficult thing to do, because of all the emotional conflict that then starts to come up and they have to deal with it. But nines tend to be the most patient. They'll wait a long time, but when the decision gets finally made, and they act on it, then they come out forward, and they feel much better because that decision is suddenly done. When they have a problem, they'll fall back into the timidity of the six, the nervousness. They'll almost become, instead of just being peaceful by themselves and saying, go with the flow, they say, I'll go with the group. Even if the group is going someplace they don't want to go, they become afraid of expressing themselves. It's not so much being okay, it's pretending to be okay. And so, in order to stay okay, I've got to stay more aware because I'm in real trouble now and I've got to do something different. I'll stay with this group because as long as I'm with them, I'm safe. So they almost lose that sense of identity, self-identity, that when in health, the six really goes for. It's that sense of becoming more harmonious. Nines feel themselves very harmonious with nature and what's going on around them. It's when you're around one, you know it. They're very peaceful and very almost no expectations of you, so it's very easy just to be with them. But when they step out, there was a story that we heard once about a lawyer. Believe it or not, a lawyer who's a nine. No conflicts, all right. But you know what he did? He was a corporate lawyer who was taking care of things like contracts and things where he didn't have to be seen. And this opportunity came up to be a company lawyer for a different company where this person could then be the legal representative counsel for anyone in the company who had a legal question. This wonderful nine was given his own office, this wonderful salary, his own telephone number, and people came to see him and ask his advice. And so he made a statement about who he was. Now, he didn't become any less of a nine. He still liked things to be pretty much peaceful. But he now existed as an individual. And he was administrating. He moved into this administrative role, which means moving in to take care of more than just himself. And it was a wonderful situation. He was very happy with it, and as far as I know, he's still there. This type one, which is our final type of the night, the biggest problem they have, because they define themselves as being hardworking, which means I'm going to do what I can to change what's not right, what's not in order. I need to change this. They're very discerning. They're very able to troubleshoot and see the whole situation and say, this is what needs to be done. Do it. And here's how I want you to do it. The character of Meg Ryan in When Harry Met Sally is a good example of how the ones do things. When the waitress says, can I take your order? The one says, oh, good, somebody to order. I'll have this and this and this and this. And if you don't have this, I'll have this and this and this. And if you don't have that, I'll just have salad. But I want the dressing on the side. It's just a list of things to do. The hardest thing that the ones have to deal with is their internal anger. Because to be angry means to lose their virtue. And if they lose virtue, they're not perfect. And if they're not perfect, they've got to be perfect. So I won't be angry, I'll just say, I'm not angry. I'm not angry. And you say, well, aren't you? You look a little angry. I'm not angry. And when they're confronted with this, it makes them crazy. Because there's all this energy, and they don't know how to, they can't, how do I improve myself if I'm already perfect, because that's my idea of myself, so I'll just work more, I'll work harder at it. I'll get more rigid, I'll get more stiff. When they fall down, they take on the gloominess of the fall. I'm not perfect. I've always been imperfect. I'll never be good enough. Darn. And it becomes real self-critical. Instead of taking their ability to discern and poke it outwards and say, you know, if you hung that picture just a little bit more, I mean, if you touch this and straighten it just a little bit, people will be able to read it better. Okay. If they, instead of trying to change other people, they say, you know, the next time we build a bridge, we really ought to increase the structural strength of the steel so it doesn't collapse in a windstorm. You know, they have the ability to find out where the problem is. But when they focus that laser down on themselves, they do a lot of damage. And that leads to depression and this gloominess that the average four tends to carry around with them. Because being gloomy, well, you're not just sad, you're gloomy. When they go to health, though, it's a very interesting change because for the one, there's no use for play. Play is not useful. It's unstructured. All right. Tomorrow at 3:15, I will play for 15 minutes. What are we playing? What are the rules? No spontaneity? No, thank you. But when they're healthy, they realize, like the five realizes that he knows enough, or she knows enough, the one realizes, maybe it's good enough as it is. Maybe I don't have to work till 2 in the morning. I'm going to go home and play with my kids. I'm going to be more flexible. I'm going to allow spontaneity into my life. So that's the direction of growth for the one. And that's the bell for Vespers. And I thank you all for coming tonight. That's been a great.